and welcome. I'm Rain Newton-Smith, the CBI's chief economist, and welcome to this special podcast around trade in services and the global opportunity. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two very special guests, Joe Twist, the CEO of the Association for UK Interactive Entertainment, and Johnny Seebacker, Director of Rider Architecture. And what we really wanted to do today is just to unpack and demystify some of this trade in services. I think everyone really understands how people can trade across borders in goods, but we don't really understand what it means to trade in services. And yet, when we look at the UK economy, as we know, over 80% of our economy is services. And if we think about the real opportunity we have in how we trade with the world, the UK is the second largest global exporter of trade and services. And yet we don't talk enough about what that is, what it means, and some of the great examples of what we've created here in the UK. And we also know that looking forward, this is a huge growth area. If we think about the overall opportunity there are from some of the specialist sectors that the UK operates in, from creative industries to education, to architecture, to design, to business and professional services, that's set to grow from 6 trillion in 2019 to over 9 trillion by 2030. So over the next decade, there's this opportunity of growth of over 50% in our trade and services. And it's one of the reasons why we at the CBI created our Trade and Services Council, which is really there to try and champion what trade and services is all about, help to improve some of the data about what it actually means and really bring it all to life. And finally, think about some of the policies we need to make it easier to trade in services, how we help to foster innovation here in the UK, but also how we help people and services move across borders. So that's the sort of high level economics pitch. But really what I wanted to do is bring that to life by hearing from some businesses, some trade associations. As part of that council, we've worked closely with the Federation of Small Businesses, with City UK, with some of the great businesses that operate across these sectors. And today we're hoping to bring that all to life. So, Joe, I wonder if we might start with you. Maybe you could just give a bit of background about your industry and how you really help that video games industry. It's so exciting and a real bastion of creativity in the UK. What does that mean to you, and how are you sort of helping to export that around the world?
Thank you, Rain, and thanks for that very useful introduction as to what trade and services is, because I think it is a question that we do keep asking in all the various working groups that we represent games in. I mean, the games industry is only about 45 or something years old as a sector. The UK is one of the birthplaces of the global industry. The global industry is worth almost $200 billion now and climbing. In the UK, we have over 2,500 businesses active in making or selling games or games-related services and technologies. And probably around 95% of them export, because we are a born digital business sector. So, you know, in the olden days, we didn't have the internet as it is now. So we had to use discs and cartridges and that kind of thing to transfer giant big digital files called games. Now we have the internet, we have the app store economy. So actually you have a lot of businesses in the UK who are micro SMEs, not just SMEs. The majority of them, around 3/4 of those 2,500 businesses, are they employ fewer than 30 people. But they might be a team of 7 people in Guildford who make a game, and it's an app store game. And as soon as it's live, it's bought, it's enjoyed by consumers all over the world. So that essentially is a trade and service, albeit it's a digital product in its own right. It's a game. But of course, making games is that unique combination of storytelling, art, and technology and innovation. So sometimes there are other services like perhaps localization or QA, which is quality assurance, that could be, you know, a service that is traded external to the UK, because this industry is a truly global one by its nature.
Really interesting to hear that. And I like that sort of almost it's an industry that was born digital and also the breadth, right? Some of the really big players, but also these, you know, just a few people working from their kitchen table, able to come up with a really creative idea that then is bought by, you know, millions of people around the world. But why is the UK good at this? Why have we managed to create such a niche in this growing industry?
I think like a lot of creative industries and innovation-based industries, we are a nation of storytellers, and we're just a bit strange sometimes as well, which is always helpful for telling quirky stories and coming up with different ideas. I mean, you know, we're the proud, you know, birthplace and owners of Tim Berners-Lee, for goodness sake, and Turing used AI and used games. AI and games went hand in hand for his work. So we've got a real rich heritage of both creative industries and storytelling, film industry, advertising, architecture, design, as well as technology and innovation and a real rich startup culture. And that's also been because we have had a very stable regulatory environment and supportive in terms of business environment. It's very easy to set up a business in the UK. So all of those things have really helped, especially in terms of the games industry. You know, of course, we had the BBC Micro, we had ZX Spectrum Factory, the Timex Factory up in Dundee. We've got great education institutions. We've got the best games course in the world up at Abertay in Dundee. So, you know, we have all of those in sort of ingredients really create a recipe for success. And our focus as a trade body now is, especially looking over the last 10 years where we've had video games tax relief, we've had very useful incentives for companies to invest in the UK and set up their studio in the UK. We need to continue because globally we are facing stiff competition.
Absolutely. And I love that idea of the UK as a sort of nation of storytellers. And we are a bit strange and a bit quirky, but obviously that spurs some of the creativity, and it's home, I think, on online. I certainly see it from some of the things my kids get up to on their gaming when you look at some of the creative worlds they've created on online. And I think that sort of link with universities as well, as you say, you know, University of Dundee, this world leading you know, industry has sprung up around it. So it's
actually great. Abertay, not University of Dundee, even though University of Dundee is a very good university.
Right. Okay. Sorry. But yeah, you know, great to see that growing. Johnny, I wonder if we might sort of bring you in from, you know, architecture and just thinking about, you know, some of the projects and partnerships you've been involved in. And it's just such another good, really good illustration, I think, of something we don't necessarily think of as an export, but yet is an area where the UK is really leading the world.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's obviously quite a bit different to the industry which Joe works in. I think construction generally can be it's a bit of a roller coaster ride. There's a lot of peaks, there's also a lot of troughs. I think one thing working internationally has done for us is, one, it can be hugely exciting, hugely rewarding for our people, but two, it adds a bit of resilience as well, which, you know, given what we're seeing in the UK at the moment, isn't necessarily a bad thing. And I think from a rider perspective, we've always been very keen to collaborate with other people around the world. We can learn a lot from others. We recognise that not all the brightest minds work at Rider, so why not learn from other experts around the world? And I think it's really a question of, do we collaborate or do we compete? And we've got a really nice balance in terms of, we have our own international offices. We've got a presence in Hong Kong, Vancouver, Amsterdam, but then that dovetails nicely with what is the Rider Alliance, which is a group of like-minded organizations around the world who will come together to collaborate on opportunities, generally on opportunities where we're stronger as a collective. They're not projects that we would win on our own, but we win them by teaming up and forming a collaborative team to help clients establish their goals, essentially. And that's kept us really agile over the years, and it's something that's continuing to work quite well for us.
And Johnny, if you could unpack a bit more some of that advice that you're providing for clients, what are some of the projects that you're sort of helping businesses to create around the world?
Currently, we've got quite a lot. We've exported, you know, we've got a lot of, I guess, experts in Rider in you know, public sector work, for example. And I think some of the way in which we approach public sector works very attractive to the likes of Southeast Asia. So in Hong Kong, we've recently collaborated with another practice where we've done West Kowloon Regional Police Headquarters, huge police tower, huge headquarter building on the old Kai Tak Airport in Hong Kong. And I think that's a great example of where we've collaborated with another practice who were well established in Hong Kong, had boots on the ground, so to speak. But we could come in and bring that international expertise from that sector, and that dovetailed quite nicely. And from a business point of view, on the back of doing a project of that scale, that's allowed us to then open up our own office in Hong Kong, where we're working now with a range of different public and private sector organisations, a lot of education work, a lot of interior fit-out work, commercial work. So a real mix, so sort of taking our knowledge and skills from what was a UK base historically and exporting them into that market. Likewise, in Australia, we're working on a lot of residential opportunities, so built to rent, which has become very prevalent in the UK. That's a sector which, if we believe the economists, and why wouldn't we, that is a sector that's going to be very, very buoyant in current years. Oh, in Australia, we've teamed up with our alliance partner I2C out there, and we're doing a number of schemes in Australia and in New Zealand, where again, they have the boots on the ground and the infrastructure, and we're able to bring that expertise to the party. And like I said earlier, it's fantastic for our people to give people the opportunity to go and work in Hong Kong for 6 months, 12 months, Australia, 6 months, 12 months, whatever it may be. That's really attractive to, one, our current people, and two, the people we're trying to attract to the business.
Yeah, and I think that's a really, interesting dimension as well, is to think when you are a business that's able to export around the world and starts to build a presence in other countries, the sort of opportunities it opens up for your staff. And it sounds like you've got, a good foothold in most of the major continents around the world. So Hong Kong and Vancouver, and it sounds like you're a growing business in Australia as well.
Yeah, we are. And the economy in Australia, for example, it's been growing year on year. Their population, particularly in the eastern cities, Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, they're expecting huge population growth in those cities. And obviously infrastructure, construction generally, it needs to be able to keep up with that growth to ensure those places are, seen as global success stories, I guess. And likewise, every place has its own nuance. You take Vancouver, for example. Everything in Vancouver, very onerous, and rightly so, with regards to high-performing buildings, net zero carbon, passive house. So doing a lot of projects like that in that part of the world, which is fantastic in its own right, but I think the bigger picture for Ryder is that we're able to download that knowledge and then bring it across to the UK, to Europe, Southeast Asia, et cetera, and just share those learnings around the world.
Yeah, and I think that touches on another area where, the UK does have a comparative advantage, or is building up a knowledge and expertise around, designing green buildings and the whole sustainability advice, whether it's in the built environment or, across, or in transport, or across the whole spectrum. And interesting to think, yes, when you're exporting in another market, how you can then bring some of that expertise into newer markets. I'd like to maybe just talk, and Johnny, you touched on it. We've obviously had some, I guess, turbulent times in the last few weeks around policy. I think one of the things would be really good to reflect on maybe is some of the policies we need to see to make it easy for businesses to trade across borders, particularly in services. And, it's so much is centered around people. It'd be really interesting to get your thoughts around that. And maybe we can then also start to think about what, if we were giving advice to new businesses trying to establish a toehold in new markets, where we go with that. So, Joe, maybe just back to you around that wider policy landscape. I mean, you touched upon it in your sort of first answer around why we're seeing this innovation here in the UK. But, what do you think we can really do to keep the UK as being one of the leading centres for the creative industries?
Well, the key issue for us and for many sectors is talent and skills, and particularly people who are combining art with STEM skills. So we talk about STEAM, not just STEM, and those polymaths are the future. We need people who have systems thinking. I know architecture needs that, computer science needs that. So we need those people who have that combination of arts and humanities understanding, as well as computational thinking. That is the new literacy of the fourth industrial revolution. And it's the one thing that when we're talking to territories like China, the Indian continent. They have very good technical skills, but that combination of arts and storytelling and technical skills and the curiosity that we seem to be able to foster in the UK, that combination is the secret ingredient, really. So in the games industry, pre-Brexit, we had, you know, a third of our workforce was international and 19%, 19, came from the EU. And that is because we need that diversity of skill sets. We need the diversity of languages. We need the diversity of perspectives that feed into shaping a great game, which appeals to global audiences. So that's one issue. The second biggest issue for us is not messing with the data adequacy decision that we waited a while for. And data flows across borders is absolutely essential for every business, I would say, even if you don't realize it. But it's certainly incredibly important for the games industry. We are a data-driven industry in the sense that we are digital, so obviously data flows. So if there are impediments or regulatory divergence from the UK around that, then that could cause unintentional barriers to businesses wanting to even have their products available in the UK. So those are the two big issues. I mean, obviously, we also always work very closely with the Department for International Trade. You know, we do trade missions. China is a huge territory, albeit has got slightly more problematic and challenging for businesses. But we're looking at those emerging territories, the African nations, Latin America. You know, these are where the new, particularly mobile first games companies are going to be, you know, really springing up. And we need to be able to access those markets, and businesses want to be able to collaborate and access, find distribution partners or publishing partners or development partners on the ground, as well as access those huge potential player base and audiences. So, you know, for us, it's incredibly important that Department of International Trade continue to work constructively with industry, and particularly industry bodies like trade associations, so that they really understand how targeted support, such as the Trade Access Program, which was incredibly important and has been replaced by something that's not so agile, flexible, or helpful to businesses, how we can make sure that we're actually supporting businesses in the way that they need. So those are just the three kind of key areas for us.
And maybe just to unpack a bit some of that, I think just where you ended on that, the Trade Access Program, I mean, what did you like about the previous program? And you know, when we have a new prime minister in place, which we will by the time this is out, you know, if you were sort of going on that day one, how would you advise you really design that so it works well for businesses like your members?
Well, that is just one of our priorities. Really, the priority for us is around the incentives that have meant so much to the industry. So video games tax relief, the UK Games Fund, those kinds of incentives, but and also investment in skills. And then Trade Access Program. We administered that on behalf of Department of International Trade. It really accessed the support that small companies really needed. It really was flexible enough to be able to, you know, not all trade shows and sectors work the same way. And it really was flexible. That meant that it really supported the cost of actually going to these important trade shows like Gamescom in Cologne and GDC in San Francisco, which can get really, really expensive for a small, medium enterprise, especially a micro SME. So it was flexible, it was targeted, it, for a small amount, delivered a huge return on investment in terms of business wins and contacts made. The replacement scheme is far less flexible. And if you've been to one trade show, you can't really use the incentive there or the support. So it's very, very much narrowed the support that SMEs can access, which is a great shame.
And maybe just coming back to that place you started around people and skills and how we work on that. And Johnny might come to you next on this. But I really liked what you said, Joe, about STEAM. So I think what you're saying is that is STEM, but you put arts and humanity and creativity in the centre of STEM skills. You know, it's obviously really important in our schools and you know, and universities, but I guess also for adult skills, what would you see as really important to create those sort of that full steam ahead, I guess.
That's the name. We're going to take that. We're nicking that for a report. well, I mean, I think it is the investment of how you can support those subjects, you know, at the school level, but then also in FE and HE, that combination of those subjects. We run a an education program called Digital Schoolhouse, which trains the teachers, and they then get trained and deliver compelling workshops to primary schools around computational thinking, which is done in a much more creative way. So you're using a game like Just Dance, for instance, to teach them about algorithms, or magic tricks to teach them about logic, or instructions of brushing your teeth. So you're using a lot of unplugged techniques to give confidence to teachers to be able to dispel some of the stereotypes about computer science, which kids unfortunately still have. But then there's an awful lot more. You know, the games industry really has a very young workforce in the UK. About 61% of the workforce in the UK is under 35, which is very, very young. And we need to focus on retention and development of skill sets who are transferring, people who are transferring from other sectors into the games industry. You know, we really need to work hard, and we could do with some government sort of partnerships to be able to create those pathways into the industry, not just from a young age, but also from an established career elsewhere into the industry, because that's going to help us, and those are transferable skills that can help other sectors as well. So, you know, I think there's an awful lot that we need to do around skills, but industry can't necessarily do it itself, particularly when we have things like the apprenticeship levy, which just is not working for a lot of the creative industries, albeit not for want of trying.
Yeah, Nick, that's certainly a common theme around the apprenticeship levy. We need something that's just much more flexible, much more modern. I think even, you know, the idea that in our modern economy, you just send someone offsite one day a week for a year is how you pick up these new digital skills, right? We need just a much more modular approach, and your industry, I think, really epitomizes how we could do it differently, right? And really help upskill so many different people. Johnny, I wonder if we might sort of bring you in and talk about sort of people and skills and how your company has approached that, and what you would want to see from government in that sort of, you know, public-private partnership to really help to deliver the skills we need.
Well, I would echo what Joe said. Skills and talent is a big problem facing the construction industry, facing architecture. One of the things we found is that the construction industry continues to be very siloed and very fragmented, and we want to work in a much more integrated way, which we often think is possibly more welcomed in some international markets than it sometimes perhaps is in the UK, down to, I guess, complicated procurement is one thing. I think on skills and talent, one of the things that we've started to do is we've actually instigated our own educational course called Plan B, which was a rider brainchild, if you like, and we've got a number of other organisations, the likes of Arup, not McDonald's, some of the big players in the industry to support it. And that's the initiative whereby we take young people who perhaps don't know what they quite want to do in terms of university. They can come and do a placement with Rider, with Arup, with whoever it is. And they'll do 3 months, and say they'll do 3 months with an architect, they'll do 3 months with a quantity surveyor, 3 months with a contractor on site, 3 years building services engineer, so on and so forth, along with doing a qualification at college. And we have found that to be absolutely brilliant in terms of engagement from the people who do the course, and also from, I guess, the benefit from the companies that sponsor it. And what it allows them to do is, after 2 years, they get a qualification, and then often they can fast track into a sort of second year of a degree in, say, architecture, for example, if they realise that's where their passion is. One, they're working and they get the experience of being at work, but two, they get a much more rounded understanding of the industry generally. And I think if people have a much greater understanding of what each member of a design team does, then the likelihood is, in simple terms, you'll collaborate more, you'll integrate more, and the result will be better for the client and the end users. And that's something that was started in Newcastle. We've got it up and running in the northwest now, with having conversations in the southwest, and who knows, that might grow to international markets as well in the fullness of time. But again, I think Joe picked up on it. The other thing we've done is DIT have always been hugely helpful in terms of facilitating tours, opening doors, etc. And then utilising just local chambers of commerce once we're in an area to sort of unlock knowledge, grow our network and find out where the opportunities may be. And then I guess finally, which I guess is sometimes overlooked, but really simple, just asking our own people. We've got about 400 people around the world, and it's incredible when you ask what might be quite a complicated question, how many answers come back from, you know, 6 degrees of separation and all that, in terms of who they know, where they've been, who they've worked with, trying to keep on abreast of that in terms of the knowledge that we hold within the organisation as well is hugely helpful.
I really like that. It sounds like that plan B placement really worked by giving individuals that quite in-depth knowledge of different sectors of the business to really understand, so people can find their passion, whether that's for architecture, surveying, or being on site and really help to project manage some of these big builds. Is that part, do you think, of what made that success of that skills program, is people being able to see the different parts of the industry and get excited about, you know, their own particular passion?
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. And I think if you think of a sort of a traditional route to architecture, for example, architecture is generally not something you've ever studied in your life. And then all of a sudden you go to university to do a course that you think you might know about, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's the same for a lot of careers in the construction industry. So I think this way it gives people a rounded, broad perspective of what they may or may not like, where their passion may be before they make that commitment to university. We're seeing architecture courses adapt, not necessarily because of Plan B, but because they're having to in terms of attracting students. So, you know, the second degree of architecture, it's now quite commonplace to go down a degree apprenticeship route, which takes 3 years, but you get your sort of traditional part two and your professional qualification at the end of it, which we're finding with our people is just a much more attractive route, sort of continuing to work, still doing your studies, and just a really nice blend rather than it being so sort of absolute as to one route or the other.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like from both of you having that diversity of skills within the talent development program is a sort of recipe for success. I wonder if we might sort of end with this question of almost, if I'm a newer business and I'm thinking about trying to expand into new markets, how we might benefit from some of the experience both of you have developed within your industries and from your clients and members. And Johnny, you sort of touched on it there. I thought it was really interesting to hear this idea about using your staff and what they know about new markets. I think that's something even just from, you know, the UK, our universities, right? We have so many amazing students that come from around the world to study here in the UK, and then they go out to other countries as ambassadors or end up working in UK companies, but obviously with real deep knowledge from around the world. So, but I guess, yeah, maybe to both of you in turn, Johnny, if you're a new business trying to get a foothold in a new market, what would be some of your top advice, pieces of advice to really get going and discover new places?
I think there's a couple of things. I think one, you obviously need to be targeted in your approach. I think it's very easy to get very excited about working internationally, and you could go for everything and win nothing without that sort of targeted approach. And I think what we've learned, it's what I said at the start of this discussion around, do you collaborate or do you compete? And I think that's around, you know, investing the time to understand the markets that you're interested in, understand who the other players are, and, you know, really being honest in terms of, you know, are we really going to be able to sort of get into this market on our own, or are we better collaborating? And we've sort of, I guess we've got three strengths. We've got our own offices in markets which we've been successful in being able to build a presence. We've got our Rider Alliance, where we collaborate with like-minded organisations around the world frequently. And then we've got one-off JVs, which may be in response to a particular opportunity. And I think those one-offs are just around just being able to be agile enough to respond to them when they land. And certainly in the construction industry, sometimes things do land out of the blue. So having that set up and that agile process to be able to go for those opportunities is something that's stood us in good stead. And I think the other thing is just patience. I think certainly in the construction industry, certainly working on the larger architectural projects, you know, some of them are like turning oil tankers in terms of the decision-making process and how long things take. So it's about having that long-term view rather than any sort of short-termism around we'll do this and we'll make a few quid and move on. That's never been our approach. It's always been for the long term and for the benefit of our people and for the benefit of our clients ultimately.
Yeah, thanks, Johnny. I really liked some of that advice of really having a targeted approach, thinking about how you collaborate and where you want to compete, but also having patience, right? To expanding into new markets, you need to be there for the long haul to really make this work. Joe, it'd be great to sort of bring your experience in. I know obviously with so many of your members, you're helping them to sell those games across so many different borders and reach new customers. What would be your sort of piece of advice to a new business trying to think about how they expand into new markets?
Well, I mean, it's very, very different in the games industry because you have the different distribution platforms or platforms like Steam, which is for PC games, or the app stores, which aren't available in all countries, but majority. And so it really depends on your business model and the type of game you're making. But, you know, the industry is very collaborative because we know that, yeah, there are 3 billion players globally, but people like to play lots of different kinds of games, and there's a whole bunch of people that we haven't reached yet. So it's really about, I guess, understanding, you know, if you want to be reaching markets that are hard to reach, like China. So that is where coming on our trade missions, being part of Yuki, being part of whatever the Department of International Trade does around any of those kind of market analysis is really important. Learning from others who've been through that journey, sharing that best practice and that knowledge through events that the industry runs is really important. We've collaborated this past 2 years because of the international trade events contracting, obviously, up until now. We collaborated with Creative Enterprise and Creative England to run some scale-up programs, which are entirely free for businesses. We've also just launched with Barclays a new mobile accelerator program for mobile games businesses. And those are really important free programs of quality support that really help you build your business. Because actually, you know, it might be about, and as I say, exporting and trade and services in the games industry is a lot easier because we're digital products. If your game's available on the App Store, it's available. It's much more about how you actually make sure your business is sustainable. So your plan, your business plan, your pitch, your understanding of the audience, your basics of business, which let's not forget, sometimes businesses forget. Once you've, if you're accessing that type of resource, it's incredibly important to make sure you are a stable business who can then take advantage of some of the opportunities that might be offered through the opening up of a new market or territory in a territory that you haven't explored before. But essentially, you know, for us, games are they're cultural products. So there's also that sort of cultural understanding, which I think that's a difficult nut to crack sometimes when we talk about games being available across the world. There are different localizations that take place within games, so it's in different languages. But then you've got, again, the Indian continent is a great example, 200 different languages. You've got different cultural tastes around how a game, what the story is, or the kinds of characters that you include. So it's much more about culturalization of games as it is about localization of games and is about the nuts and bolts of business.
So fascinating just thinking about all the things that help businesses to expand in new markets, whether that's partly around thinking about the finance or making sure it works across borders and different cultures. So I mean, look, it's been an amazing conversation. Maybe I will just go on a quick fire to each of you. But before we round off, just to say, you know, what would be your one hope for the future around trade and services, or the one thing you would change? We've heard so many things, I think, about, you know, steam, full steam ahead, how we have arts and humanity along with some of those STEM skills. I really like that idea about we have this nation of storytellers and how we can build on that. And I think, Johnny, from you, just, you know, that importance of having patience and a targeted approach if you're going to expand into new markets, and really thinking about how we develop skills for the long term and plan B. That program you've been running, that gives people a taste of different parts of the industry. It feels like we've got all the recipes for success. But if there was one thing you could change or you really hope for the future, maybe to each of you in turn before, Johnny, what would you say?
I'm not sure about what I would change. I guess the one hope for the future is just, you know, just being able to, I guess, as trusted advisor for our clients, just to be able to follow them around the world and collaborate with the best people in the world for the best outcomes. That's hugely exciting. It's hugely exciting for everyone involved, particularly our people. Great opportunities, and it's fun as well. And you know, there's nothing wrong with work being fun. And it's an exciting time. So long may it continue.
Absolutely, Johnny. I totally agree. Work should be fun if this is what we're doing and creating meaning for clients around the world. I really like that. And Joe, over to you. What would you change, or what's your one hope for the future?
Well, we are in the industry of fun in video games. And I suppose one hope would be that we see a much more confident embracing of games as a distinct sector, as a sector that is fueling the economy, that continued apace during the pandemic, that is resilience, that is future facing, that is building the skills and the economy of the future, but a lot more confidence in embracing this sector, because I think people still have a little bit of cultural bias around games, which they need to shed. And it would be brilliant to see games being embraced more in the classroom, because they are all brilliant learning vehicles in their own right. You know, you've got the architects of the future in Minecraft right now.
Absolutely. And I've certainly seen how my children can create those amazing worlds. And I think it's a really lovely note to end, just having that confidence and fun and creativity for the future and some of the opportunities there are for the UK around the world if we can get the right policies in place and importantly that vision of making the most of the opportunities that are out there. So it just leaves me to say a big, huge thank you to our guests, Johnny Seebacher, Director at Rider, Joe Twist, CEO at the Interactive Entertainment Association. A big thank you from me. Thank you for joining us, and look forward to that optimistic future.